turn it over. Let's escape and go back to the beginning.
Okay, good idea.
You want to just go to the first slide?
Okay.
Okay, so I will start with the subject of this group on overlap in a completely different direction and start talking about climate change and how that's affecting medicinal plants as well as some of the other issues that we've been speaking about. So I'm going to cover, in order to do that, I have to cover a whole lot of topics, and I apologize for doing it quite so superficially and quickly. And I have lots and lots of data on all of these issues, but I can't go into it today. First of all, I'd like to stress the fact that in order to establish whether plants are being over-harvested or whether they're being sustainably harvested is an incredibly complex procedure. You have to go out and measure huge populations of plants over many years and build population models that estimate what's called a lambda to find out if it's above one, then it's a sustainable harvest, and if it's below one, then it's an unsustainable harvest. And these are pictures. We've done it on probably been able to do it on only about 8 different plants, and some of them we can't get enough data. Here are 5 plants that we've done it on and have found that, yes, indeed, they are being over-harvested and that this is a very serious problem. But it's a difficult procedure. The Celsaria lanceps is the one that we have the most data on and are the most sure that it's being over-harvested. But one of the interesting facts, statistics on the over-harvesting of this plant is not just that the population of the plant is changing, but the overall size of the plant is changing. So the plant is adapting, is evolutionarily adapting to being harvested. Because people get more money for large plants, the plant is evolving to be smaller. Did we ever get a pointer?
I don't think so.
No pointer. Okay, I can't point. But its height is on the y-axis there, and you can see that over a 100-year period, the plants are getting smaller and smaller. And we can tell this from herbarium specimens. Yes. Oh, somebody has a pointer. Lovely. Now that I'm all wired up, I can't come to you. Thank you. That's great. These people that travel prepared is unbelievable. So here's the height of the plant. And as you can see, in 1900, we can look at herbarium specimens in that period. And this is what I noticed first. When you look at the old herbarium specimen, the plant barely fits on a sheet. They're huge. And I'm going, wait a minute, this isn't the same plant that I'm seeing out in the field now. And sure enough, we went and looked at all the collections. And we can see this decrease in size of the plants over time. And the interesting thing is here on today, when we look at the biggest plants, where do we find those biggest plants? We find them in Tibetan sacred areas. This sacred area business is something I'm going to keep coming back to and try to tie in at the end, because I think that one of the few real strong hopes that I have for conservation of medicinal plants is through sacred areas. We see that traditional harvest of medicinal plants does not really threaten a traditional harvest, a light harvest of medicinal plants does not threaten the population. It is sustainable, a traditional harvest. And this is something I think we have to think seriously about. Do we really want to globalize the market for these plants? We do not have the technology to cultivate them. We do not have the technology to sustain a harvest of these plants on a global scale. But we can sustain a harvest on a traditional scale. And I think that we really have to emphasize conservation of these plants so that traditionally they can continue to be used as they always have been used. And that was kind of the point when I put poor Colm on the spot this morning. That was where I was going, but and I apologize again for that. If you look at this, again, the size of the plant, if you look in the heavily harvested areas, you can see very distinctly that the heavily harvested areas are smaller plants, and the lighter harvested areas are larger plants. And this is, this again, I'm not going to explain the whole population biology to you, but you can see that in a light harvested area, you can harvest more plants than you can in those heavily harvested areas. So it's much more sustainable. And again, this low harvested area is our Tibetan sacred sites. So the areas where we're finding those larger plants and more sustainable harvest. If Tibetan doctors go into sacred sites to harvest, they go through rituals. Sanataji has taken me through many of these rituals to show me how they would traditionally harvest, and it's only by doctors, only under the conditions of an illness that must be treated. It's not for commercial purposes. Another piece of research that we did was looking at the location of medicinal plants. This is an elevational gradient from about 2,000 meters up to about 5,000 meters. And you can see it goes all over the place where medicinal plants are found. Different medicinal plants are found at all elevations. But unsurprisingly to this group, since we've been talking about it so frequently, is that the most number of medicinal plants, the most diversity overall of plants, is found in the alpine area. But most botanists find this very revealing. Because you have these big, gorgeous forests, and you just automatically think that they must be tremendously biodiverse. But in fact, it's the alpine meadows that are the most biodiverse. And lo and behold, that's where you find the most medicinal plants as well. So we put a lot of emphasis on that alpine area. We thought that this was an area that needed more attention. And we worked with Tibetan doctors, one of whom is here now, Sanataji. This is in a slightly younger form, but then I'm in a slightly older form myself. So, and I would like to make my own acknowledgement of a great mentor of mine who has recently died, and that's a friend of Sanataji and mine. Anna passed away, and I'm in complete denial. I'm going to find his reincarnation. He cannot have died. So this has got me through my first 4 points sort of quickly, and I'm sorry for being quite so brief on them, but it gets me to my main point, and that is climate change in the Himalayas. And in case you're not up on this sort of thing, and this is not reproducing well, so you can hardly see it, but there's a real dark purple area over the Himalayas here, and this indicates that temperature in the Himalayas is rising faster than anywhere in the world except the poles. You know, so the poles are melting like crazy. But the Himalayas is also warming at a tremendous rate. Not only that, but in the precipitation, there's a little, you can almost see that one. There's a little purple splotch there in the Himalayas. That means, unlike other parts of the world that are getting drier, the Himalayas is getting wetter and wetter. And it's stippled, which means that it doesn't matter whose model you look at. Everybody's model comes up with the same thing. So in the Himalayas, we're expecting tremendous climate change, warming and getting wetter and wetter. So a 5 to 6 degree temperature increase and a 20 to 30% precipitation increase. Glacial retreat, of course, we all know about. And the fact that the Tibetan Plateau and the Himalayas in general are climate drivers for the entire world. So we're not just talking about the Himalayas. We're talking about the Himalayas being the driver for climate all over the world. So when the Himalayas change, the whole world changes. So this is a very important issue overall, but it's a very important issue to those of us in this conference as well. These are repeat photographs, and again, they're not reproducing tremendously well. You can't see. But in general, what's happening, tree line is moving up. Here we have old photographs from the 20s, and we can see, well, you could if you could actually see anything. You could see tree line is getting higher and higher now in the present day. Shrub line, there's a little bit of shrub in the old photograph, and there's lots of shrubs now in the other photograph. Glacial melting, the glacier used to come, it kind of peaks out around the corner right here, and it now, this is in northwest Yunnan, this glacier, it's almost 2 kilometers shorter than it was. So it's we can see in those repeat photographs, we can see the effect of climate change very clearly. And what happens as the vegetation is moving up the mountains, trees are taking over, the shrubs are taking over, what's happening to that alpine vegetation that's so important, so biodiverse, and so important for medicines? What's happening to that on the top of the mountains? Fortunately, there's a group called GLORIA, which stands for Global Observational Research Initiative in Alpine Environments, which is a terrible acronym. But nonetheless, GLORIA, you can say. So they have a standardized format for measuring the effect of climate change on alpine environments. So I joined this group. I said, great, we can compare with every place all around the world, from Siberia to the Andes to New Zealand. We can, use the same, it's not a perfect methodology, I'm not crazy about it, but at least it's comparative around the world. I do it slightly different than everyone else does. Everyone chooses these summits, and we go through this methodology, and we laboriously count all the plants in those quadrats, and we take voucher specimens, we put in little temperature monitors, we all do this. What I do differently is, here's me, big me and little Tibetan doctor, is that I go out with Tibetan doctors, and we do this together, and teaching me what these plants are used for, what their interpretation of our results are, and what their thoughts and cosmologies are about climate change. So we're doing a lot of Tibetan perceptions on climate change, cosmology on climate change, as well as finding out what's happening with medicinal plants with climate change. I'm a botanist, so I have to throw in beautiful pictures of Himalayan flora. And these are some of the plants that are being most affected by climate change. I've been talking about the snow lotus. This is one that grows at the very, very highest elevations. And as plants are moving up, and it takes 10 years to develop, at least 10 years to develop one of those plants. As these faster-growing, more aggressive plants are moving up the mountains, we're losing. These slow-growing alpine plants cannot compete. And so we're going to be losing some of these very important medicinal plants that are very slow-growing. So we're gathering the data on that. Just to show you the data on the medicinal plants, these are, we use summits of different height, different elevations here, from about 4,500 to about 5,500 meters in general. So we're way up there. And this is, these are the increasing summit elevations, and you can see the number of, total number of species here, and the percentage of medicinal plants at each of the sites that we've done. We've done 3 sites in northwest Yunnan now. We've got 5 sites in progress in Nepal. We're just starting sites here in Bhutan. We've done some site selection in Tibet as well. So we're hoping to make this a trans-Himalayan project. But we have a mean of 62% of all plants are medicinal plants up there. So a huge proportion of these alpine plants are medicinal plants. This correlates very well with that earlier study I showed you. This is the overall biodiversity, and this is the useful plant biodiversity, and it too is just about 62%. Now, there's nothing magic about 62%. It's just kind of reassuring that we're in the ballpark anyway. And as one Tibetan doctor pointed out to me, all plants are useful, it's just some of them we don't know what they're used for. Which I thought, that's cool. Now I want to get to my point on sacred sites. We've already seen how important sacred sites can be in some senses. We've done several studies on sacred sites. One of them, we looked at random We put down random plots on a map, and we looked at sacred sites. And we find overall that sacred sites are perfect. We find that sacred sites are protecting against over-harvesting. The plants are bigger. The populations are sustainable. They protect plant richness and biodiversity. We have greater richness and biodiversity in sacred sites. And in high elevation sites, they have many more endemic plants. But what happens with climate change? You have a sacred site, you've got all this biodiversity protected, and then all of a sudden all these plants are moving up the hill. You know, what happens then? You know, all these plants are having to migrate up the hill. All of a sudden they're no longer in their sacred site. How is a sacred site going to protect against climate change? And I think that this is true. I think that there's a problem with these sacred sites as far as protecting medicinal plants. Now, of course, that's not the reason for sacred sites. I'm not completely naive. But they do act as conservation mechanisms. But if we're talking about climate change, we really need to think more in terms of a sacred landscape with corridors in between sacred sites, with concentration on larger zones and sacred lands. Of course, Tibetans already have this. They have a traditional zoning system in the high elevation, which particularly concentrates on the alpine zone. And that's where we're finding so many of these Tibetan medicines that are threatened. So I think that we really need to concentrate on legalizing, on recognizing sacred site, not only sacred sites, but sacred zoning and interconnections, a sacred landscape. I think we need to do more research on these, not only as tools for conservation, but also as connections with the spiritual world. So we have a lot of collaborating institutions. I'm not doing this by any means on my own. I'm from the Missouri Botanical Garden, the Kunming Institute of Botany. Professor Peixing Ji is here. They collaborate with me. The Shangri-La Alpine Botanical Garden, the University of Tribhuvan in Nepal, the Institute for Conservation and Environment here in Bhutan. We just went out on a week-long hike looking for sites. Gloria, which is at University of Vienna, and the Environmental Change Institute at Oxford. And we got funding from everywhere we can find it. So, anyway, thank you very much. Okay. Questions?
The sacred zones, a comment and a question. I wonder if there may be other reasons why the plants are shorter. It could be, for instance, that there's more grazing on that land, but I don't know whether it's an area that's grazed, number one. And number two, if it is grazed, I know that some people have been talking in Tibet about putting in fencing for sacred zones. And I wonder what you think about that, because that might lead to another set of problems, like if it's not grazed and so forth. So I just want some general comments on that.
Well, first of all, snow lotus, the Sausuria lanceps, grows higher than the grazing, and it grows kind of in cliffs and areas where I think grazing is not the issue with that particular plant. Of course it is with many other plants. And I completely agree. I think that grazing is it's like the Alps. They realize that they no longer have the Alps they thought they were preserving because they have kept the grazing animals out of their parks. And so all of a sudden they lose the plants that they're trying to protect because grazing is part of the environment. And I think fencing the area, I think we need culturally appropriate ways of conserving these areas, and I'm not sure fences are culturally appropriate. I would, you know, be all in favor of reinstituting migrating migration all over again. You know, I think that's an incredibly ecologically sound method. You know, it's kind of like rotational grazing, or the original rotational grazing, where you've got the big herds that come through once a year, and that's it. But I think we have to be very careful about being culturally appropriate when it comes to methods for conservation. You can get me back now.
I was trying to think of something. Thanks for sharing your really important work with us. I just have one question. When you speak about going with Tibetan doctors to these sites and asking about their cosmological beliefs about climate change, I'd like you to expand on that a little bit more.
Cute. Well, I don't always do the cosmology at the site. I mean, I do the cosmology at the site when I get. I do cosmology wherever I get the opportunity. But you know, I often go to monasteries. I do any kind of interviews, and that I always get in trouble when I give those papers because the methodology is a bit loose. You know, No, but we've interviewed a tremendous number of people, including some of the people in the audience here on Tibetan cosmology beliefs about climate, and you know, of course, Tibetan. I could go on for a year on Tibetan cosmology and climate change, but you know, their general attitude is the climate change that we're viewing now is nothing compared to the climate change that they have seen in the past. You know, the great flood, the beginning of the earth, the great winds that are going to blow the universe to smithereens, and so on. But nonetheless, in the human cycle, it's there, and the gods are there, and so on. So, go ahead, ask the question. Okay, thank you very much.